Johnson, so as not to be too obvious in his actions. Minutes later, the train arrived, its warning horn sounding while it decelerated sharply as it approached the underground platform. It came to a stop, and its doors opened. As expected, very few disembarked, and Tarig was swept aboard in the wave of passengers, managing to come to stand a meter behind Tenson. Tenson moved away, taking one of two empty seats along the left side of the cabin. Tarig immediately followed, but was beaten to the seat by another man, forcing him to continue standing. It was a 15-minute ride to the Siskina station, with several stops along the way. By the second stop, the man sitting next to Tenson had departed, and Tarig immediately took the empty seat. Finally, he was in a position to speak with a man claiming to be Suvan Navarro. Unfortunately, Tarig found a lump in his throat. More accurately, it was a lack of courage. He was about to take a step from which there would be no turning back. He thought he had crossed that line when he sent his first message back to the Karazari, but this was definitely crossing that line. The last exit before Siskina came and went, and Tarig still had not found the courage to speak. Finally, as they began to decelerate into Siskina Station, he found the strength. "I am a friend of Yassi's," he said just loud enough for Tenson to hear him. Tenson offered no noticeable reaction, other than turning his head slightly and glancing at Tarig. "It is imperative that I speak with you," Tarig added. Tenson still did not respond. Finally, as the train came to a stop, Tarig spoke again. "I said I heard you," Tenson said, cutting him off. "Denton Prospect and Iliander, 20 minutes," he added before rising and leaving the train. Tarig sat motionless, stunned, failing to disembark before the train doors closed. He had just initiated contact with a former noble of Takara, a man who had been exiled and stricken from the records, and had returned to steal the Tayenta right out from under the noses of the Dusan Empire. He would have to catch the southbound train at the next station and move quickly to make the rendezvous. But for now, he was still alive, and that was good. "Odds and evens, highs and lows," Captain Nash's voice instructed over Aiden's comset. 5x2 start at 10, manual execution as rehearsed. Striker 3 has lead, attack sequence starts in 10 seconds. "Striker 3 has lead," Aiden replied. "Check in, boys and girls," he ordered his crew. "Port gunner, starboard gunner, systems, sensors." "Jumping in 3, Kenji added, completing the check sequence. "Guns down," Aiden reminded his gunners as the cockpit windows turned opaque for the jump. 2 seconds later, the windows cleared, revealing the cargo ship Soster only 100 meters ahead of them. Aiden immediately pitched their nose up sharply, bringing the 4 plasma torpedo cannon barrels on their underside onto the Dusan Octofighter trailing its charge. "Torpedoes locked," Kenji reported. "Let him have it," Aiden ordered as he pressed the firing button on his flight control stick. 4 plasma torpedoes streaked across their windows, illuminating the cockpit with red-orange light. 4 seconds, Kenji warned. 3 of the 4 torpedoes slammed into the trailing octofighter, causing it to come apart in a brilliant explosion. 6 seconds, Kenji reported as bolts of plasma energy from Striker 3's port and starboard gun turrets opened fire on the Dusan fighters on either side of the Soster. 8 seconds, Kenji warned as the octofighter to port of the Soster broke in two, the result of plasma bolts slicing through its midsection. "Oh, yeah!" Ledge exclaimed over comsats. "Pitching down," Aiden warned his gunners, who would have to adjust their firing angles accordingly. "I'm with you," Ollie assured her captain. 10 seconds, Kenji announced with a sense of urgency. "Time to go." "Just a moment," Aiden said as the octofighter to starboard of the cargo ship was blown into hundreds of pieces. "We have to jump," Kenji insisted. Aiden got a torpedo lock on the final octofighter, a few 100 meters in front of the Soster, and pressed the firing trigger. As soon as the cockpit was awash with red-orange light, he pressed his jump button. "Jumping!" "Jesus, Aiden!" Kenji exclaimed. "You are 4 seconds too long in the engagement zone." "We got all 4 of them, right?" Aiden replied. "Dags, tell me we've got that last one." "Just a moment," Sergeant Dagata replied. "That's not the point, Aiden," Kenji chided. "The next gunship was supposed to take care of the lead octofighter. By staying in 4 seconds too long, you almost put us in Striker 4's jump path." "But it didn't," Aiden reminded him. "We got him, Skipper," Sergeant Dagata reported. "And we took out all 4 escorts ourselves," Aiden boasted. "Nice job, people." Kenji just shook his head. Brazil's gonna have your ass, Aiden, he warned, and with good reason. Bullshit, Aiden argued. We had the shot, we took the shot, and we got out before Stryker 4 jumped in. It's called taking the initiative. It's called disregarding the battle plan, Kenji insisted. It's called disobeying orders. What if Charnel would have jumped in 1 or 2 seconds early? Then I wouldn't have to be listening to you complaining, Aiden joked. Not funny. You know damn well Charnel would never jump in early, Kenji. For one, she's too anal about the battle plan, just like you. Second, she knows that I'm likely to stay a second or two longer, but would be sure to be out of her way before she jumped, as long as she jumped on time according to plan. That's why there's a 5-second gap minimum between attack jumps so that we don't jump into one another. The battle plan has wiggle room built into it. All I did was use that wiggle room to score another kill, and all without receiving any return fire, I might add. But Nash and Roselle are looking for compliance at this point, Aiden, not innovation. They need to know you can follow the plan. That's the only way everyone else can be sure we've all got one another's back. I'm sorry, Kenji, I just disagree. If I jumped in early, I'd agree that I was breaking the attack plan, but like I said, I just used the wiggle room. If we had gotten the shots off a few seconds faster, we might have taken them all out within our 10-second window. Don't you see, Aiden? Kenji argued. It's not about whether or not you can do it, or even if you can do it safely. It's about you taking risks just because you can, not because the situation calls for it. I promise you Roselle and Nash are going to say the same thing. Just wait and see. Strike leader to all strikers. Target is secure. Take up monitoring positions, Captain Nash instructed over comms. Aiden's eyebrows rose. He could have at least congratulated us on 4 kills in 14 seconds. Oh, he will, when we get back to the Aurora. Kenji warned indignantly. Derek walked in and out of the streetlights along Iliander Boulevard. It was now 25 minutes since the man claiming to be Suvan Navarro had directed him to the approaching intersection. He only hoped he had not grown impatient and left. Derek had almost missed the southbound train at the Willette station and was forced to run up the stairs, across the foyer, and back down the escalator to the southbound platform. He had ducked into the train just as the doors were closing, and had then run from the train to the street upon arrival back in Suskina. Tarek glanced about, looking for any sign of the man going by the name of Tenzin Dalit, but he was nowhere to be seen. In fact, there were surprisingly few people on the streets. They were only a few blocks from the hotel in which Lord Matisse had instructed Tenzin to stay, which was probably why Tenzin had chosen this location. Iliander Boulevard was more of a back street than a main thoroughfare, used mostly to access the backside of businesses which faced Kefin Prospect. As he approached the intersection, he slowed his pace somewhat, just a little, enough to be easily diverted by a whisper from the shadows, but not so much as to attract attention or even worse, suspicion. He could see the intersection of Denton Prospect and Iliander 50 meters ahead, and he suspected that at any moment Tenzin would step out of a doorway to intercept him. Instead, someone grabbed him from behind, dragging him to the narrow alleyway between two buildings. Tarek wanted to yell out in panic, but his mouth was firmly covered by a man's hand. Tarek struggled at first, but had to settle for simply trying to stay on his feet, as the stranger dragged him backwards into the darkness. A moment later, Tarek found himself with his back firmly against the wall, held tightly by his throat, with the tip of a knife threatening to pierce his chest just below his xiphoid process and slightly left. Move and my blade will pierce your diaphragm and find its way easily to your heart, causing you to bleed out in seconds. His abductor threatened in a barely audible yet menacing growl. Tarek froze, afraid to even breathe. You wanted to speak with me? The voice continued. Speak. I work for Lord Matisse, Tarek began. Keep your voice down, Tenzin warned. I know of your conversation with him. Tarek felt Tenzin's grip on him tighten, the tip of his blade already poking through Tarek's jacket. I know who you are and what you wish to do. Then I guess I have no choice, Tenzin said, a tinge of reluctance in his voice as he prepared to thrust his knife deep into Tarek and end the young man's life. Please, Tarek begged. I can help you, he continued, lowering his voice again. I work for the Karazari. Now I know you are lying, Tenzin said, again tensing up to deliver the fatal blow. I speak the truth, I swear it, Tarek insisted. I am in contact with them. With who? Tenzin demanded, becoming agitated. Captain Scott, Tarek replied, certain of his imminent demise. Fool, Nathan Scott died 7 years ago. You have sealed your fate. I speak the truth, Terrig pleaded. He is alive. I've spoken with him and Jessica Nash aboard the Mystic Empress only a few weeks ago. I can prove it.
A convincing effort, Tenzin admitted as he again prepared to take the young man's life.
He said to tell you, come hard to starboard and pitch down 45 degrees and do it quickly.
Tenzin paused, momentarily confused. Then he regained his composure.
Why? He barked again, tensing up. Why did he tell me this?
Because a bunch of comm drones were about to slam into you.
Tenzin could not believe what he was hearing. His grip on the young man eased a bit, and the tip of his knife began to slowly back away from the young man's chest.
At what speed were the comm drones approaching? He wondered.
10 times the speed of light,
Terrig replied in a barely audible whimper. Tenzin released his grip on the young man's throat, stepping back.
My God, is it possible?
He asked no one in particular.
Is he really alive?
He looked Terrig in the eyes as his emotions swirled wildly within him.
It is true,
Terrig promised, still afraid to relax.
He is back in command of the Aurora and is working with General Tellus and the Gatajak and Eliza Ta'akar.
Then the princess survived the attack?
Yes. Together they have reformed the Karazari.
Then they have operatives on Takara,
Tenzin realized. They sell, perhaps.
I'm afraid I'm it, Terrig told him. As far as I know, but I suppose there could be others. I don't know. I've only contacted them once, to tell them about you and your conversation with my employer.
Then you are not a covert operative?
No, not really. I believe they refer to me as a digispook.
Tenzin thought for a moment. And you can communicate with them?
Yes.
Without fear of discovery?
I believe so, yes,
Terrig replied.
Through a relay on Haven.
Tenzin looked at Terrig with one eyebrow raised.
First rule for a covert operative is to reveal as little information as possible, even to friends.
I'm sorry,
Terrig said. I just didn't want you to kill me. I have a wife, as do I.
Then you truly are Suvan Navarro, captain of the Avondale?
I am,
Suvan confessed as a wave of relief washed over him. His odds of succeeding in his impossible mission had just gotten measurably better. Admiral Gagliardi moved briskly down the corridor from his personal jump shuttle's private hangar to the nearest shuttle tube.
I take it things did not go well,
Commander Maclay said as he met the Admiral at the intersection and fell in step alongside him.
Nothing ever goes well when dealing with the Alliance Council,
the Admiral grumbled, disdain in his voice.
How many voted against your recommendation? The Commander wondered. It never got to a vote. Scott voiced his opposition, which made it unnecessary. He prefers to wait until all possible diplomatic solutions have been exhausted. Those damned battle platforms are going to get their marching orders and disappear into FTL, making them nearly impossible to find until they're within striking distance of Earth.
What can we do? The Commander said. Admiral Gagliardi ignored the Commander, realizing it was a rhetorical question. They turned the corner into a shuttle station, where a handful of technicians were waiting to board.
Make a hole, the Admiral barked.
The men moved aside, clearing a path for the Admiral and the Commander. Commander Maclay turned back toward the men preparing to board behind them.
Next one, he instructed.
A moment later the door closed and the shuttle car accelerated smoothly away, its inertial dampening fields making the sensation of movement nearly unnoticeable to its occupants.
What diplomatic solutions does the President plan to use? The commander wondered as he took a seat opposite his commanding officer.
The Jung haven't answered a direct message from us in over 5 years, and their envoy and his staff are all in custody.
To be honest, I don't care, the admiral admitted. I'm tired of having my hands tied behind my back by bureaucrats and politicians, none of whom have the slightest inkling of how to protect their worlds from the Jung.
The admiral looked at his trusted aide and sighed.
We need to prepare a clean slate.
Commander Maclay did not look pleased.
Admiral, clean slate is meant to be a last resort. It is meant to be used during an internal insurrection or after a devastating attack by our enemy. Which is exactly what will happen if we do not strike now and strike hard.
Then launch the strikes, take the initiative, and do what you know must be done. Leave the politicians to run their worlds while you protect them. Hell, they won't even know the strikes have occurred, and by the time they find out, the war will likely be over.
Oh, they'll find out, and much sooner than you think, the Admiral insisted.
Scott's had his spies watching me since the day I was reinstated. Against his better judgment, I remind you. But Clean Slate is essentially a military coup, Admiral. I know what the hell it is, the Admiral quipped. I wrote the damn thing, but it's not a coup. I fully intend to open up all worlds to elections once the Jung have been dealt with and all the Alliance worlds are fully capable of defending themselves. If the Jung are defeated, their defensive needs will be greatly reduced, Admiral Gagliardi pointed out. Commander McLeay did not look convinced. If the public ever finds out... If the public finds out, nearly half of them will agree with what we did, the Admiral insisted. At least half of the people on Earth, and to be honest, those are the only ones I really care about. Times have changed, Commander. Unfortunately, the governments of Earth have not. It's a dangerous galaxy, and we've only discovered a fraction of what's going on out there. If we let people like Dayton Scott weaken us, the Jung will roll over us again and again. I will not let that happen. Even if it means violating your oath? The oath is impossible to uphold, the Admiral insisted. You make a promise to protect the people, while at the same time promising to yield to their will, even if their will makes you unable to protect them. The reason men like us are in charge is because we understand that sometimes two wrongs do make a right. The shuttle car began to decelerate as it approached the Fleet Command and Administration Complex, deep within the asteroid that was Port Terra. Commander McLeay sighed as the car came to a stop. I'll get everything ready, sir. However, I beg you to make one last plea to President Scott, perhaps in private. Maybe you can use our knowledge of his son's activities to convince him to play ball with us. It won't work. I know Dayton Scott. But at least history will show you that you tried everything possible before taking such drastic measures. I don't give a rat's ass what history says, the Admiral replied as the shuttle car door opened. As long as it says we won. But I see your point. And you are certain this method is secure? Suvan wondered as he examined the information on the view screen in his hotel room. Nothing is 100% secure, Tarek warned. But I checked this place out. They do quite a lot of business from all over the sector. Is Molo Twine the only thing they sell? No, they sell many things. Some of them made from Molo plants, some not. Then why the twine? There are only three products that the Karazari are monitoring for messages. Molo Twine, Haven Prayer Baskets, and Dunsel Spice. I chose Molo Twine, which is commonly used as candle wicks. I even started making my own candles just in case. Good thinking, Suvan praised. I still cannot believe that Nathan Scott is alive. He looked a lot younger than I expected, Tarek commented. You are not the first person to make that observation, believe me. So I just order one of those three products, put the encrypted message into the special delivery instructions field, and that's all there is to it? That's it. But I should warn you, it took nearly a week for them to respond to my first message. If you told them about me, then I suspect they will be watching for messages more closely, Suvan insisted as he began typing his message. Tarek watched Captain Navarro while he typed, wondering what he had been through the last few weeks. Do you really think you can steal the Tayenta? To be honest, my odds of success are extremely low. However, they are no longer as low as they were an hour ago, he added with a wry smile. Thanks to you. He looked at the young man. It took a lot of courage to approach me like that. It was also not very smart. I couldn't think of another way. Next time, write a note and slip it into the target's pocket or something, Suvan suggested as he pressed the order button. The order is placed. How do I get the reply? It will come in the shipping confirmation message. So the Aurora is nearby? Suvan wondered. I don't believe so, Tarek replied. I think she is in an entirely different sector, to be honest. They didn't really tell me much. You do know you have gotten involved in a dangerous game, do you not? I'm starting to realize that, yes, Tarek admitted. I just hope my wife doesn't find out. Give me your comm unit, he added. Why? I know a trick to make text messages more secure. Suvan handed Tarek his comm unit. One of the advantages of being a digispook, I imagine. Tarek nodded as he worked. Does your wife know what you are doing? She does not know the details, but she knows that I am here and that I am risking my life. And she doesn't mind? She minds, Suvan replied. But she also knows that I cannot turn my back on such things. You do not worry about her safety? Tarek wondered. I've taken proper steps to ensure she is as safe as can be expected. I would strongly suggest that you do the same for your wife.
I'm not sure I know how, Derek admitted. Perhaps you should send her away on an extended vacation, someplace far.
Easier said than done, I'm afraid. My position in House Matisse does not pay that well. Besides, she would not leave without me, especially if she knew what I was doing.
He handed Suvan his comm unit.
Done. You can now send me text messages without fear of the Dusan reading them. At least not immediately.
What do you mean, not immediately? Suvan wondered.
No encryption is 100%, Tarek explained. It's just a matter of how long it takes to decrypt it.
And this one? Suvan asked. How long will it take them?
A few days, perhaps a week.
I'll try to restrict its use.
Derek looked at his watch. I should be getting home.
He looked at Suvan as he rose.
Thank you for not killing me, Captain.
You're welcome, and call me Tenzin, remember?
Of course,
Derek replied, feeling stupid. The subject rarely leaves the building, and when he does, he is protected by a moving shield, capable of repelling both energy and projectile weapons, Crispin explained. In order to complete the assignment, I would need access to the interior of the facility. Even then, I cannot promise anything.
Mr. Dakota looked displeased. He took a long sip of his drink, gazing out across the courtyard as shoppers moved between stores.
I would hate to see you return to captivity, he said, his insincerity obvious, especially after getting another taste of freedom.
You called this freedom?
Crispin laughed. A dead man has no freedom. I can deal with captivity if I must.
Perhaps, but I fear your significant other finds incarceration a bit more challenging.
Crispin glared at his handler, thoughts of his beloved Sarah hovering on the edge of reality in a drug-induced haze, at the mercy of guards who despised her very existence.
If you expect me to complete this mission voluntarily, then the odds of success need to be better than trying to free Sarah of my own accord.
Perhaps I underestimated your abilities, Mr. Dakota declared, setting his glass down on the table.
Are you refusing to carry out your mission, Mr. Bornett?
I am saying that the mission cannot be accomplished by anyone without a way to get inside the target's considerable security measures. But I suspect you already knew this.
We had hoped you might uncover a weakness that we had not, Mr. Dakota admitted.
He placed a credit on the table, then rose, buttoning his suit jacket.
I will make some inquiries. Good day, Mr. Bornett.
Crispin picked up his glass, quickly tossing the remainder of his beverage down his throat, as he watched Mr. Dakota disappear into the crowd of weekend shoppers. He knew that killing the president of the North American Union would be an impossible task, and he was quite sure his employers had been aware of that fact from the beginning. What he didn't understand was why they had made the offer in the first place.
Crispin added another credit to the table and then rose to depart. His answers would come soon enough. Of that he was certain. Captain Hunt stepped into the forward cargo bay of the Ansel Kinney, joining the four members of his original crew whom he felt he could trust, and the eight men and women who he had contacted to replace those he could not.
To those of you new to the Ansel Kinney, I bid you welcome, and I thank you all for agreeing to join us,
he greeted as he made his way through the group to the middle of the bay. All of you, new and old alike, will eventually be leaving everything and everyone you know behind for a new life in another part of the galaxy. I know the Ansel Kinney is only a cargo vessel, but make no mistake, what we are planning to do with her will put us in harm's way. While those of you who served during the original Jung War are no stranger to such risks, those of you who have served with me on the ship the last few months are. If any of you do not wish to remain aboard, you will be free to resign your positions, complete with all earned bonuses, just prior to our final departure from the Sol Sector.
The crew of the Kinney looked at one another, unsure of what they were getting into.
You mind telling us where we're going?
Mr. Dalton, the Kinney's chief engineer, asked.
Not until everyone has made their decision, Captain Hunt replied. I haven't even told these people where we're going or why, he added, gesturing to the new people joining the crew.
Then why the hell are they here? Mr. Dalton wondered.
Because they believed me when I told them that if they knew, they would want to come. That is the question the four of you now must ask yourselves.
Are we going to get hazard pay?
Crewman Parks asked.
Doubtful.
Captain Hunt replied. Are we going to get any pay? Crewman Sackoff wondered.
Some, but how much I do not know.
What the hell are we going to get? Mr. Dalton asked.
Pride in knowing you are doing something important, something to help change things for the better rather than hauling cargo to nameless asteroids. Pride in knowing you're following someone you can believe in, rather than some arrogant, power-hungry, revenge-seeking old fart with delusions of grandeur.
Tell us how you really feel, Chris, Denny remarked with a laugh.
I take it what you're planning isn't sanctioned by the Alliance or by our employers, Mr. Dalton surmised.
No, it is not, Captain Hunt admitted.
Well, hot damn, count me in, the old engineer exclaimed.
Captain Hunt looked at the other three men on his original crew, each of them nodding their heads in agreement with Mr. Dalton.
Then we're all staying, he said, shaking for any looks of doubt.
Very well.
So, what are we doing?
Mr. Dalton asked. We robbing a bank or something?
Not exactly, Captain Hunt replied. We're going to start funneling portions of our cargo to the Karazari Alliance in the Pantoris sector.
The Pantoris sector's a 2-week journey for this ship, Captain, Mr. Dalton reminded him.
One way, don't you think the Alliance is going to notice we're missing?
We're not going to the PC, at least not at first, Captain Hunt explained. We'll rendezvous with Karazari cargo ships here in the Sol sector. That way, we'll stay on schedule.
But won't the Alliance notice that some of their cargo didn't reach their depots? Crewman Sackoff wondered.
That's where Mr. Sousa here comes in, Captain Hunt replied. He'll hack each depot's automated cargo inventory system, making it think that all the cargo has been delivered.
But they have inspectors, Crewman Sackoff said. I have a buddy who flies them around from depot to depot, double-checking inventory.
Which is why we only expect to do this for maybe 5 times, Captain Hunt explained.
Eventually, we're going to have to leave the sector and head for the PC ourselves to avoid getting arrested.
So we're basically becoming pirates, Crewman Park surmised.
Depends on your point of view, Captain Hunt replied. I prefer to think of us as freedom fighters.
Whose freedom are we fighting for? Crewman Sackoff wondered.
The same people who once fought for our freedom, Denny said, speaking up proudly. The Coronarians and the Takarans.
And everyone else in the Pantoris sector, Captain Hunt added.
Damn straight, Denny agreed.
Who's leading all this? Mr. Dalton wondered.
I kind of want to know that myself, Chris, Cassandra chimed in.
Captain Hunt smiled. I was saving the best for last. Nathan Scott. He's alive and well and leading the Karazari rebellion against the Dusan in the Pantoris sector.
What?
Cassandra's mouth dropped open in disbelief.
That's impossible.
That's what I said when he first told me, Denny said.
You told Denny?
Cassandra said in shock.
Only because I was sure he would join me, Chris defended.
But we dated for 6 months, Cassandra reminded him in protest.
That's why I wasn't sure you'd want to go, Chris admitted.
This is getting really good, Mr. Dalton exclaimed. Michael wiggled his way through the last meter of the crack that connected the cave in which they had been hiding for the last 2 days to the outside. As his head poked out into the open, he paused for a moment, moving only his eyes from side to side, looking and listening for any sign of Dusan's search parties. Fortunately, all he heard were the creatures of the Coronarian night, tweeting, whooping, and cawing. In the distance, he could hear the sound of the nearby river where he had obtained fresh water 2 nights ago. Satisfied that no one was nearby, Michael wiggled his way into the open, immediately shifting over into another crevice in the side of the mountain, concealing himself. For several more minutes, he listened and looked, waiting for the slightest hint that they were not the only humans in the area, but found none. Finally, he tossed a small rock down the crack in the side of the mountain, signaling to Burke and Cuddy, waiting inside the cave, that they could begin their ascent. Michael closed his eyes, breathing in the cool night air. 2 days inside the tiny cave had been more than enough. He only hoped it had been enough time for the Dusan to give up their search. He continued to listen, cringing with every grunt and groan emanating from the crack as Burke and Cuddy wiggled their way up to the surface. If anyone was nearby, they would surely hear them and respond. However, at this point, they had little choice. They were out of both water and food, and the smell of their own bodily waste had already made their hiding place unbearable. It was time to move. Burke, still nursing broken ribs, was the next to emerge, helped along by Cuddy pushing him from behind. He slid out of the crack and rolled onto his back, taking in a deep breath of fresh air, enjoying it every bit as much as Michael. Michael reached over and pulled Burke toward the crevice, urging him to find concealment as Cuddy emerged from the crack and quickly joined them. They waited for several minutes while they recuperated from their climb and continued to listen for signs of trouble. Again, they found nothing but the sounds of the forest at night. "We will follow the ravine down the side all the way to the river," Michael explained. "Then we'll follow the river downstream until it crosses a road."
"And then we follow the road?" Burke surmised.
"We will see." Michael carefully stepped out of the crevice, looking around the forest as he moved. "We must move quickly but quietly. We will try to make it to the nearest town before dawn. If we are unsuccessful, we will have to find another hiding place for the day."
"As long as it isn't a cave," Burke muttered as he followed Michael out of the crevice.
"I got right," Ledge exclaimed as their gunship came out of the jump.
"I got left,"
Ollie followed.
"And I've got the middle,"
Aiden mumbled as his plasma torpedo targeting system locked onto the Doosan octofighter directly ahead of them. He pressed his firing trigger, sending four balls of red-orange plasma towards the target ahead of him, but the fighter pitched up and disappeared in a blue-white flash of light.
"Shit! The bastard jumped!"
"That was quick," Kenji said, his tone ominous.
"They must have been expecting us,"
Aiden realized as he pitched down to dive underneath the approaching cargo vessel.
"Four jump flashes," Sergeant Degatta reported. "Two to port, two to starboard."
The ship rocked as bolts of energy slammed into their shields, momentarily turning their protective barrier pale orange with each impact.
"It's an ambush," Kenji exclaimed.
"You got him?"
Aiden asked his gunners.
"Oh, shit!"
Ledge exclaimed as he swung his turret around and opened fire on the newly approaching targets.
"I've got three coming in fast,"
Ollie yelled as she fired away in rapid succession.
"Striker 4 just jumped in behind us,"
Sergeant Degatta added.
"Shields down to 50%, Chief Benetti warned. 8 seconds,
Kenji announced.
"Char!"
Aiden called over comms.
"It's an ambush. 8 bandits. Repeat 8.
"Actually, it's 6 now,"
Ledge corrected.
"Whatever,"
Aiden replied.
12 seconds.
Kenji announced.
"Time to go."
"No argument here,"
Aiden agreed as more energy weapons fire lit up their shields and rocked the ship violently.
"Jumping!"
The gunship's windows turned opaque and the shaking stopped as the ship jumped away from the incoming fire.
"Coming to port 60 down 20,
Aiden announced with a sigh of relief as he steered his ship onto its new course.
"Got the next jump ready?"
"Already locked in,"
Kenji replied before Aiden finished asking.
2 jump flashes. Sergeant Degatta warned. "One directly behind us, 20 clicks. The other ahead, 50 and 15 degrees above. I think they're searching for us."
"If we see them, they see us," Kenji warned.
"How the hell did they track us?"
Chief Benetti wondered.
"They didn't,"
Dayton insisted. "They're jumping random intercept patterns, trying to box us in. Dial it up 2 late minutes and recalc."
"I'm on it,"
Kenji replied.
"Target behind us has acquired,"
Sergeant Degatta warned.
"Launch a ghost drone,"
Aiden wondered.
"Ghost drone away,"
Sergeant Degatta replied.
"Flying straight and true. Target is firing."
Aiden twisted his flight control stick, putting the ship into a roll to port.
"Jump loaded,"
Kenji began to announce. Aiden wasn't waiting and pressed the jump button again. His shields were already down by half their strength, and he needed them for another pass at the Doosan fighters who were escorting the Hotchkiss. Their windows turned opaque again as they jumped 4 light minutes forward. Aiden immediately rolled to starboard and dialed up a 3 light-minute escape jump.
"We're supposed to be turning to port again, Aiden,"
Kenji warned.
"They'll guess that,"
Aiden insisted, tapping the escape jump button, instantly sending his gunship ahead 3 light minutes.
"I'll come about here instead."
"That'll put us 10 seconds behind sequence,"
Kenji warned.
15-second gaps this time,"
Aiden replied.
"That leaves us a 3-second window. I'll jump out early to catch up."
"You jump out early?"
"Ha, fucking ha,"
Aiden exclaimed as he finished his 180-degree turn.
"You got the attack jump plotted, smart guy?"
"Before you even started your turn,"
Kenji replied.
"That's why I love you,"
Aiden joked as he pressed the jump button. Their windows again turned opaque, but when they cleared, the Hotchkiss was nowhere to be found, nor were the Doosan octofighters. Only a massive debris field remained.
"What the hell?"
Aiden wondered as pieces of debris bounced off their shields.
"Where'd everybody go?"
"The debris is from the Hotchkiss,"
Sergeant Degatta announced in shock.
"Are you sure?"
Aiden asked, also surprised.
"Who the fuck took out the Hotchkiss?"
"Striker leader to all strikers,"
Captain Nash called over comms. The Hotchkiss is gone. The Dusan took it out themselves once they realized they were outgunned. Escape and evade. Rendezvous at the outbound rally point. We're done here.
Holy shit! Aiden exclaimed, still in disbelief. How many people were on board that ship?
He asked his co-pilot.
Probably a dozen. Why the hell did they kill them?
They didn't want us to have the ship, I guess, Kenji surmised.
Those are some cold fuckers, Chief Benetti commented. Escape and evade jump, plotted and locked in, Kenji reported solemnly.
Damn, Aiden said, shaking his head as he pressed the jump button. Despite his growing contempt for the aging president and lifelong politician, Admiral Michael Gagliardi gave both the man and his office its due, if for no other reason than to maintain appearances. No matter how careful one was to keep such meetings clandestine, eventually word got out, and when it did, he needed to at least appear to be following the rules. He had learned long ago that those who followed the rules strictly as written were doomed to a mediocre career at best. Rules had to be treated as guidelines, not as gospel, and he had done so with wild abandon at times, especially as of late, which made it all the more important to keep up appearances. It mattered not what you did, rather what you could prove you had done. Therefore, Gagliardi was careful to give smart salutes to all who greeted him, and patient respect for the security measures that protected the President of the North American Union and the leader of both the Earth and Sol Alliance. Admiral Gagliardi smiled at the irony as he approached the outer office and President Scott's secretary.
"Good morning, Admiral," the young man greeted. "The President is expecting you."
"Thank you," the Admiral replied as he moved past the man toward the President's office. The two men in black suits who flanked the doors reached over in unison, pulling them open for the Admiral, allowing him to enter the President's office without breaking his stride. President Scott never liked to keep anyone waiting, feeling it was a sign of disrespect. He was also not one to play the tricks of positioning or sitting slightly higher than his guests. It was one of the few things Admiral Gagliardi actually liked about Dayton Scott, and it almost made him regret what he was about to do. Almost.
"Admiral," the President greeted, stepping out from behind his desk to properly greet the man who had caused him such concern in the past few weeks.
"May I offer you something?"
"Thank you, no," the Admiral replied, moving quickly to one of the overstuffed chairs in the middle of the office.
"As you wish," the President replied, nodding to the gentleman at the door.
Admiral Gagliardi waited for the doors to close and for the President to take his seat before reaching into his pocket and pulling out a small sound suppression field generator, which he placed on the side table to his right and activated. President Scott watched the Admiral, no surprise evident on his face.
"We both know you record every conversation that takes place in this room," the Admiral stated plainly, "be it live or via comms."
"I take it you plan to get directly to the point of your visit," President Scott replied, one eyebrow raised.
"You know why I am here, Mr. President?" the Admiral began.
"I believe I made my position quite clear yesterday."
"How about we cut the crap, Dayton?" the Admiral insisted. "I know that your son is alive and has been all along. I also know that he and his cohorts attacked the Cobra plant on Kohara and made off with at least 6 gunships. I also know you or someone from your staff, for example your daughter Miri, helped them."
"An interesting story," the President replied. "I assume you have evidence to back up these accusations?"
"I don't need evidence. Some computer-enhanced video of your son running about during the attack on Kohara will be more than enough to provoke public outrage, probably enough to bring down your presidency. And as you are well aware, I would be well within my rights to declare martial law and assume control of Earth until such time as a new leader could be elected. And we all know how long that can take."
President Scott studied the Admiral for a moment, taking measure of his words.
"Allow me to share what I know to be true," the President began after a pause. "I know the Zheng ships which intruded into Alliance base in the Sol sector were not operated by the Zheng. In fact, it is highly doubtful the Zheng are even aware that such transgressions have occurred. I also know you are well aware that the incursions are more likely part of a false flag operation by the Dusan in an attempt to keep us from interfering with their actions in the Pantorus Cluster, which, I should point out, is technically still our ally. An ally who came to our aid when we most desperately needed them."
"And I suppose you have proof of these accusations as well?" the Admiral wondered.
Probably about as much as you have. Sensor logs of the same Zhang warships in both Sol space and Pantora space, only weeks apart. Not entirely convincing, I admit, but enough to create just as much public outrage should the need arise. Admiral Gagliardi sighed. Not a sigh of resignation, but one of sadness.
Of all the people of Earth, you have suffered more personal loss than most. Your world, your wife, your eldest son, your son-in-law, now your youngest son has become an enemy of the state. You should want revenge more than any of us, Dayton.
Revenge is not my right, the president replied. Not as the leader of my world. My responsibility is to the people. My family knows this, especially Nathan.
Yet he committed the one act that is sure to bring the full force of the Zhang Empire down upon us,
Admiral Gagliardi pointed out. You say this about a young man who offered his life to save everyone else's, and then put those very lives at risk for the sake of his own skin. The admiral replied sharply. His posture changed from one of defiance to one of pleading, leaned forward slightly as if trying to make a personal connection with the man opposing him.
Dayton, you and I both know the Earth will never be safe until the Zhang are completely disarmed and at our mercy.
You speak of the Earth alone, Dayton countered. Perhaps you have forgotten what an alliance truly is.
Stop dancing around the issue, the admiral snapped. The Zhang, the Dusan, all of them. They are a threat to all free men and women, be they from Earth, Tau Ceti, or any other world. They must be stopped and stopped cold, all of them.
There are other ways to prevent a war, the president stated calmly.
Negotiate? You want to negotiate with the Zhang? Hell, we've already fired the first shots.
In response to what we mistakenly believe to be acts of aggression by the Zhang Empire, the president replied, taking great measure to remain calm despite the admiral's increased volume and emotion. If presented with the same evidence that we discovered after the fact, they will surely see.
They will see what they want to see, the admiral insisted. Just like all people, they will see an excuse to attack us with everything they've got. They are Zhang. That is what they do. That is how they become an empire, for Christ's sake. They will do whatever is necessary to achieve their goal.
And what would their goal be? President Scott asked, still remaining calm.
To rule everyone and everything,
the admiral replied, dialing his emotions down a notch. And I, for one, do not intend to allow them to do so. Admiral Gagliardi leaned back in his chair, regaining his composure.
I have dedicated my life to the protection of my world, and like our enemies, I too am willing to do whatever it takes to achieve our goals.
And what do you perceive our goals to be? The president wondered, his eyebrow again shooting up. It was the first sign of emotion the old politician had displayed since the admiral had activated a sound suppression field generator.
The safety and security of the Earth and all her reasonable allies.
Through the destruction of the Zhang Empire, the president surmised.
If need be, yes.
And who decides if an ally is reasonable? The president wondered.
We cannot protect everyone, the admiral insisted with a wave of his hand. We barely have enough resources to protect ourselves, and the Dusan are but a handful of ships, a few dozen at most.
The Zhang number in the hundreds, with at least a dozen battle platforms included in those numbers, which, I should remind you, will be receiving marching orders any day now, if we do not take those platforms out now while we can.
I've heard this before, admiral, the president said, cutting him off. Mr. President,
Dayton, the admiral was again pleading. What we have is a basic difference of opinion, the president explained. We both seek the same end result, peace and security. Our disagreement is only in how this end is obtained. Fortunately, I hold the office of president, not you. It is my finger on the button of the very weapons you command, admiral. Let's not forget that.
Admiral Gagliardi leaned back in his chair again. Are you sure about that, Mr. President?
He asked, his right hand tapping the side of a sound suppression field generator, as if to remind the president that nothing they had said had been recorded. This time it was President Scott who sighed.
I've never liked being threatened, Admiral. Need I remind you that I alone have the power to remove you from your post with only a single utterance?
I believe you need a majority vote of the Alliance Council, the admiral replied. Only to confirm your removal, the president corrected. I can muzzle you for an indefinite period while we debate the issue. However, I admit that we are better off with your experience and expertise at Fleet Command. And yet you ignore my most fervent recommendations. And with good cause, the President replied, which you have now confirmed. I have always respected you, Dayton, Admiral Gagliardi said as he rose from his seat. It saddens me to know that we will now be staring down one another's barrels, he added before turning and heading out of the President's office. Admiral Scott sat unmoving, watching the Admiral leave. As soon as the door closed, Miri entered his office from a side door. A sound suppression field? She said, spotting the device as her father reached over and turned it off. He brought a sound suppressor into the office of the President? Michael Gagliardi fears no one, the President said, and apparently respects no one as well. He turned to look at his daughter. I'm afraid things are about to become very dangerous.
Dangerous for whom? Miri wondered.
For all of us.
What have you got? Nathan asked as he entered the Aurora's intelligence office.
New message through Molo Front,
Lieutenant Commander Shinoda replied. And?
He answered every question correctly, Jessica said. It's him. The man going by the name Tenzin Dalit is Suvan Navarro.
You're sure?
As sure as I can be without standing face to face with a guy, Jessica assured him.
That this was a good thing, the Lieutenant Commander commented.
It is, Nathan agreed, assuming he is Navarro.
If he is Navarro, shouldn't he have gone down with his ship? Lieutenant Commander Shinoda wondered.
I spoke with Deliza, Jessica said. She said he regularly took trips with his wife outside of the Darvino system. Resorts, retreats, things like that. If he was away when the Dusan attacked.
Nathan tried very hard not to smile. The idea of adding Captain Navarro's skill and experience to their fleet, especially if it came along with a captured T'Karn battleship, was exciting. But it was also quite dangerous. What else did he say?
He basically sent us everything he knows about the T'Karn orbital shipyard as well as the Tayenta herself, the Lieutenant Commander explained. He even sent a few ideas on how we might go about stealing her, although they all seem a bit impossible if you ask me.
We already know quite a bit about the shipyards, Jessica said.
There have probably been a few changes since the Dusan took over, Nathan pointed out.
How much could they have changed in 6 weeks? The Lieutenant Commander wondered.
Plenty, Jessica insisted, considering it's probably their most important asset at the moment.
She's right, Nathan agreed. Just the ability to service their existing ships makes it priceless.
Not to mention building new ones, Jessica added.
Something that we definitely cannot let them do, Nathan added as he scanned the entire message. Get this to General Tellis and see what he has to say about it. We'll start brainstorming in the morning.
Aye, sir,
the Lieutenant Commander replied. Nathan turned and exited the compartment with Jessica hot on his heels.
You're not really considering stealing the Tayenta, are you?
Jessica asked as she pursued Nathan down the corridor toward the bridge.
I consider everything, Nathan replied as he walked.
A nearly completed battleship. Don't you think the Dusan will have it heavily guarded?
I'm certain of it.
Nathan looked at her as he walked.
Why do you ask?
It just seems like after suffering so many casualties in the Kohara raid, you might be a little more apprehensive about taking such risks.
I'm always apprehensive about taking any risk, Nathan replied, especially when the lives of those under my command will be put at risk.
Just checking, Jessica replied.
She took Nathan's arm just as he was about to enter the bridge.
It's a long shot, Nathan. You know that, right?
I'm aware of that, yes, Nathan assured her. Maybe you should get together with Tellis and figure out a way to reduce the risk and increase our chances of success. I'm sure he could use some of your out-of-the-box thinking on this one.
You got it, Jessica replied with a wink.
Nathan turned, continuing onto the bridge, as Jessica headed back down the corridor in the direction they had come.
Captain on deck, the guard announced as Nathan passed by.
Captain, Nathan called to Cameron, my ready room.
Cameron rose from the command chair at the center of the bridge, speaking to her tactical officer as she headed aft.
You have the con, Lieutenant.
Nathan walked around his desk as Cameron entered the ready room, closing the hatch behind her.
News?
Looks like it's Navarro, he said as he took his seat. And he's got some crazy ideas on how to steal the Tayenta as well.
Anything promising?
Not really, but he may not have included everything in this first message. I know I wouldn't.
How's he getting all this intel? Cameron wondered.
Apparently he convinced one of the nobles to get him hired on as a crawler operator in the shipyard.
He's been working on the Tienta for a couple of weeks now.
Cameron looked concerned. The Tienta has to be 3 or 4 kilometers long. One crawler operator is probably only going to see a tiny portion of the entire ship, and from the outside, how much could he possibly learn about her?
All we really need is a way in, Nathan insisted. The Tienta is a Takaran ship, so Navarro should be able to figure out how to operate it.
Assuming that Deliza's family override codes are still valid, Cameron pointed out. I don't suppose there's any way to verify them ahead of time.
Not without tipping off the Dusan that the codes exist.
Can he pilot the Tienta single-handed?
Delis and his men should be able to help, Nathan explained. And all they have to do is make a few jumps to get clear. Then we can put a small crew on board and jump her back to us.
If the Dusan don't shoot her down first.
Nathan looked at her, a puzzled expression on his face. Are you always this pessimistic?
You wanted me as your XO, remember?
She replied. Shooting holes in your plans is part of the job. That must be why you liked being my XO so much, Nathan joked.
The position does have its perks.
Cameron replied with an impish smile as she rose from her seat to return to her duties.
Let me know what Tellus comes up with.
How'd you know I sent it to Tellus? Nathan wondered.
Also a part of the job,
she added as she departed the ready room. Nathan punched his command code into his console and called up the images of the Tienta that Captain Navarro had included in his message, displaying them on the view screen on the wall of his ready room. The Takaran battleship was big, nearly as big as the older Jung battleships which flanked her in the bays on either side. Nathan leaned back in his chair, staring at the images on the view screen. The Tienta would be a tremendous asset. The question that remained was what it would cost them to acquire her.
Chapter 4
How long are we going to stare at this place? Burke asked, as he, Cuddy, and Michael knelt behind the bushes alongside the roadway, peering through the foliage at the ranch on the other side.
Until the sun goes down and I'm satisfied that no one will see us approach, Michael replied.
The sun won't be down for another hour, Cuddy stated.
Nobody's moved to that place since we've been here, Burke pointed out. It's probably abandoned.
The front hedges are trimmed, the lawn is watered, and the fence and barn all appear in good repair, Michael said.
Someone lives here.
Maybe they're at work, Cuddy suggested.
It's possible, Michael admitted. But this far out, people usually work the ranch they live on.
Shopping?
They'd be home by now, Michael insisted. Dusan curfew starts at sundown. Being caught out after dark guarantees imprisonment at the very least.
All the more reason for us to get off the streets, Burke insisted.
We spent all of last night on the move, Cuddy reminded him.
Now you want to be off the streets before dark?
We were in a forest, not on the streets, Burke replied. So yeah, I want to be off them before curfew.
Burke sighed. Mostly I just want to lay down somewhere and take a nap.
There's a light, Michael announced.
Burke raised his head, looking at the distant house again.
Where?
The little window to the right, Michael replied. Probably the bathroom.
It's already getting dark, Cuddy said. Maybe they're done for the day.
It's a possibility, Michael admitted.
Why are there any other lights on? Burke wondered.
Single occupant? Cuddy suggested.
Also a possibility, Michael admitted. If it is only a single person, he or she is likely to be cleaning up. Now may be our best chance.
Chance for what? Burke wondered, not sure he wanted to know the answer.
To get into that barn unnoticed, Michael explained.
3 warm bodies in a barn all night long, Burke questioned. Don't you think we'll look suspicious on Dusan's sat scans?
Barns have hay lofts, which will shield our heat signatures from satellites, Michael explained.
Most of these places keep their power plants in the barn as well, which will also make the Dusan satellites less effective.
Wouldn't it make more sense to knock on the front door and ask to spend the night?
Burke suggested, desperate for a warm bed.
Michael looked at him.
And tell them what?
That our vehicle broke down and we need a place to hold up for the night so we aren't breaking curfew?
Cuddy offered.
A good cover story, Michael admitted. But the occupant of that house is just as likely to report us to the Dusan as he or she is to allow us to spend the night. We can't take the risk.
Barn it is, then, Burke agreed.
We need to move soon, Cuddy insisted. Our heat signatures will become easier to detect once the sun goes down and the ground cools off.
Hey, if they've got satellites they can track us, why did they find us tromping through the forest last night?
Burke wondered.
Many of our satellites were destroyed during the initial invasion, Michael explained. They had to task the ones that are still operational as needed. The area we were in was likely not a high-priority area at the time.
But weren't they searching for us? Cuddy asked.
Yes, but by the time we left the cave, their search perimeter would have expanded beyond the capabilities of the satellites servicing that area.
If they're short on satellites, why would they use them on a ranch out in the middle of nowhere? Burke challenged.
We do not know that they would, Michael admitted, but we do not know that they would not, either.
So better to play it safe, Cuddy surmised.
Precisely. Michael scanned the area one last time.
Shall we?
Michael stood slowly and carefully, as if he were half expecting someone to spot him and yell. After one last look around, he headed out across the road, walking as if there was nothing unusual about his presence. Burke and Cuddy followed, neither one looking as inconspicuous as their leader. The three of them continued down the opposite side of the road until they were far enough past the barn so that no one in the ranch house could see them, before hopping the fence and making a run for the barn itself. Michael was the first to enter, cracking the large door just enough to slip inside, followed by Burke and Cuddy. There was barely enough light spilling in through the skylights above for them to get their bearings and find their way to the area directly under the hayloft, near the tractor and the various attachments that came with it.
"This should do for the night," Michael said as he began pulling apart a nearby bale of hay.
"What are you doing?" Burke wondered.
"Making a place to sleep."
"In the hay?"
Burke couldn't believe what he was seeing.
"Won't that be scratchy?"
"See those tarps?" Michael said, pointing to the other side of the barn. "Throw one of those on top of a couple of feet of loosely packed hay and you've got yourself a bed."
"Not any bed I've ever slept in," Burke muttered as he fetched the tarps.
"How are we going to keep warm?"
"Just pile more hay on top of you," Michael replied.
"Great.
Beats the hell out of sleeping on a cave floor," Cuddy reminded him.
"Barely."
"We'll have to clear out before the sun rises," Michael warned as he spread out his tarp. "Ranchers start work early and they do not care much for trespassers."
"How do you know so much about ranchers?" Cuddy wondered.
"My uncle was a rancher," Michael explained. "He had a small place east of Ballard. My mom used to send me to stay with him for a week each summer, while she went to her annual refresher training class."
"What did your mom do?"
Burke asked as he laid down on his tarp-covered pile of hay.
"She was a critical care nurse."
"What'd your father do?" Cuddy asked as he finished making up his bed for the night.
"He never returned from his service to the Empire."
"The Takaran Empire?" Cuddy asked, sounding surprised.
"Yes."
"Hey, this hay bed isn't half bad," Burke admitted as he settled into his makeshift bed.
"You served as well, didn't you?" Cuddy said.
"I did," Michael admitted. 4.5 years, in fact."
"You're lucky you made it back," Cuddy said. "I heard that less than half who were drafted ever returned."
"What? They died?" Burke asked, surprised.
"Actually, most of them survived their tours, but were discharged far away from home, without a way to get back. Only the ones who scrimped and saved their meager pay or were lucky enough to get discharged close to their homeworld made it back."
"Which one were you?" Burke wondered.
"I was a unique case," Michael admitted.
"How so?"
"Let's just say that an unusual opportunity presented itself, and I used it to my advantage," Michael replied modestly. A shocked expression washed over Cuddy.
"Now I know where I've heard your name before," he exclaimed. "You're Michael Willard."
"Oh, we already knew that, Cuddy," Burke reminded his friend.
"Michael Willard," Cuddy repeated. "The Michael Willard, the guy who mutinied and took control of the Amaro, saving Coronair."
"Get out,"
Burke exclaimed, equally shocked. He looked at Michael.
"Is that true? Is that you? I mean, are you him? Did you save the whole planet?"
"The entire planet is a bit of an exaggeration," Michael insisted. "A few million lives at the most."
"Oh, is that all?
You really mutinied against a Takaran nobleman?"
Burke shook his head in disbelief. "Man, that took guts."
"Not really," Michael admitted. "Not when you take into account that there were at least a few surface-to-orbit nukes headed our way, and our shields were too weak to protect us."
"I don't understand," Cuddy said. "If the ship is about to be destroyed, why didn't the captain surrender?"
"Takar nobles do not like to admit defeat," Michael explained. "Some more than others."
"Still, it took guts," Cuddy agreed.
"Didn't you receive the Star of Coronair for that?" Burke asked.
"Yes, a few years later, after I returned from Sol."
"That's right,"
Burke said, remembering. You served on the Aurora with Nathan Scott. What was that like?
Far scarier than anything I went through in service to the Empire, Michael replied. Except for that mutiny incident.
So do you really think he's still alive?
Cuddy wondered. I admit it is difficult to believe, and it could be an imposter on the other end of the comms. However, even if it is not him, what he is trying to do is important enough for me to support him.